Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah, standing there by...
Kia ora, everyone. Kia ora, Karen.
Kia ora, Louisa.
It's Labor Day holiday, a day set aside to celebrate the conquest of the eight-hour workday. Do you like that word? Conquest.
Yes, I believe I selected that.
You did indeed.
Because you called it celebration and I said, no, it's got to be conquest.
Yes, I
just
I'd,
take a little credit. Think it,
yeah. So, Karen, did you know that not only was New Zealand the first country to give the vote to women, but we were also the first country to adopt the eight-hour week work day, isn't it? The way
yes. So 40-hour work week, 8-hour work day. And actually, I did know that, Louisa, because I researched it for a library's Instagram post on a Labor Day. And I even know the name of the person. So I did. And I even know the name of the person who was identified as the founder of the 8-hour work day. So I found the article in Te Ara, which is one of my favorite. I just want to put out a shout out for Te Ara, the Encyclopedia of New Zealand. Great place to look up topics about New Zealand. And I'll quote from it because I checked it out this morning again. The honor of introducing the eight-hour day in New Zealand is traditionally assigned to Samuel Duncan Parnell. A London carpenter, Parnell, on his arrival at Petone in 1840, insisted on working no longer than 8 hours when erecting a store for the merchant George Hunter. So that's not Auckland, but we also have Te Ara also takes us on to Auckland. So a little bit later in Auckland, a Chartist painter, William Griffin, led an agitation among the building trades in 1857, which achieved the adoption of the 8-hour working day on the 1st of September of that year.
Excellent. Thank you for that. So I also did a
my
research. the history is also detailed in this book, which I found in the library, Samuel Parnell, A Legacy, The 8-Hour Day, Labor Day, and Time Off by Paul Corliss. So again, reiterating the story you've just told us, and it does indeed clarify that Parnell was the first to gain the 8-Hour Day for his workers, because apparently it was quite contentious. There's a few contenders in there. So it was around about February or March 1840 when this his gain, I guess, was made with Master Hunter. They travelled on a boat together from England, and that's where he negotiated this deal.
Oh, so I didn't realise that it was negotiated before they arrived in New Zealand.
Yeah, so he did very well. So the book includes an interesting timeline of New Zealand's labour rights. 50 years after Parnell's gain for his workers... I loved gain for his workers because it wasn't set into law, of course. It was you know, that, hence the Auckland...
Yeah. It was case by case, yeah. Really, wasn't it? It hadn't been set up by a national law. Yet.
Yeah, so champions
and I believe
of the
it's tradesmen and building industry that particularly started with the eight-hour day.
Yeah, so, and then others joined in, of course. So the Maritime Council called for the 28th of October to be a general holiday, which back then was known as Demonstration Day. Then it wasn't until 1899 that Labor Day became an official public holiday and still is today. Hence our lovely long weekend. But going back to Parnell, I'd like to read a poem. It was a tribute to him by an Australian politician, I think, and a memoriam poem placed in the Sydney Bulletin when he died. So here it goes.
I'm ready.
Okay. I've got to adjust my glasses, actually. He worked with head, with heart and hand, from early youth to age. And in a new unfettered land, he taught this precept sage. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for play, and 8 hours for sleep, excel. This was the charter for each day of our wise King Parnell.
I did suspect when I heard the Excel, I was thinking, is this going to rhyme with Parnell by any chance? But yeah, I mean, 8 hours for play, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep. What's really wonderful about that, everyone, Labor Day weekend, is that it's actually an expected part of your Labor Day weekend that you go out and play for 8 hours to take full advantage of what your forebears fought for. And I'm going to say... what would be the word? Did not have the pleasure, did not have the advantages that we have today, and went down fighting and went up fighting to give us this opportunity to take care of all the aspects of our life.
And it was a fight. I mean, we can tell from this timeline how long it took to be sort of enshrined in legislation and official. So, pioneers.
Yeah. And, you know, even after the 8 hours, so right around that same time, there were, of course, what comes to my mind when I start thinking about the labor struggles in literature is there's a huge genre in Victorian times of the Victorian social problem novel. One of the people who wrote about it was actually a woman, Mrs. Gaskell. North and South is one of the most famous, which I have not read, so I'm not going to speak to North and South, but I am going to speak to another author of whom I've read many of his books, who's Charles Dickens. So Charles Dickens is quite, a lot of people know that he actually, as a young boy, went to work in a blacking factory. His father was put in prison for debt, and young Charles was sent to work in a blacking factory and had such a terrible experience there that he transcribed into one of the most touching scenes in David Copperfield. You know, when David goes and does a similar thing in a warehouse, goes and works in a warehouse with all the rats scuttling around.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
But in another book, which I had actually not read, and which I'd always assumed was a hard read and a long read, I don't know why, so Hard Times. Hard Times is actually the shortest of Dickens' novels. So I don't know why I had this impression I was mixing it up with one of the lengthiest, about, you know, a fourth of the size of David Copperfield. Anyway, so Hard Times is set in the mill country, in the, you know, in the north of England, in where the mills, textile mills.
The industrial heartland, I'm not sure.
And a little bit of both. And so in Hard Times, we were presented with some very Dickensian characters. So one is Josiah. So in particular, we've got on the two sides of the coin, we've got Josiah Bounderby, who is a rich man who is typical reaction to the poor people surrounding him are, you know, what do you people complain of? And he's always prating on, as it says, about turtle soup and Turkish carpus. And then he sort of reminded me of a Jared Kushner, definitely. Very much. A proto-Jared Kushner. And on the other side, we have this figure, Stephen Blackpool, who's sort of a martyr figure, who's this lonely, working-class man, very noble, very dignified. And he's sort of the spokesman for the poor people in the novel, of whom Dickens is taking up the part. And he's got a speech here, which I found just to give you a sample. But unfortunately, it's all written in dialect, and I am not going to attempt.
Come on, put on your best
dialect. No, I'm not going to.
Yorkshire accent.
I'm going to read it in an American accent, but I think it's still a really revealing speech and really revealing piece of Dickens writing.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you. Bounderby, the proto Jared Kushner, has just impressively folded his arms and asked, "What do you people, in a general way, complain of?" And this is Stephen's response. "'Deed, we are in a muddle, sir. Look round town, so rich as it is, and see the numbers of people has been brought into being here for to weave and to card and to piece out a living, all the same one way, somehows, twixt their cradles and their graves. Look how we live and where we live and in what numbers and by what chances and with what sameness. And look how the mills is always a-going and how they never works us no nigher to any distant object excepting always death."
Whew. Yeah, done.
Because Dickens had in particular the thing that he saw about factory work, and even if it's in an 8-hour shift, the dangers that he was recognizing was the repetitiveness of the tasks and the lack of scope for people to be able to use their imagination and brain and initiative while repeating a mindless task over and over. So, you know, every period of the labor struggle has had its own.
Yeah. And you can understand then what Samuel Parnell was doing on that boat, on that long journey from England on a mission, perhaps determined not to bring these practices or those practices to his new country. And hence we have, you know, sort of more egalitarian New Zealand and place.
Well, I think it's really true that that a lot of the people of that wave of immigration from England, the Industrial Revolution was behind a lot of it because it really shifted what people had hoped for. You know, everybody wants to make a better life in their new generation for the one that their parents had. And the Industrial Revolution really endangered that in a lot of ways. Mm. And so there was New Zealand shining at the other side of the world.
But in 2018, it would be fair to say the concept of work is no longer what it was when the 8-hour day was introduced. We are now in the era of the gig economy, gig being an abbreviation for the word engagement. So now it's used to describe the environment of short-term contracts and engagements, work engagements, that is the independent contractor, the freelancer, the casual worker, the short-term contractor, etc. So, Karen, apparently a gig worker, I've looked this up, has a better work-life balance and is able to select the jobs they want to do rather than be tied to the sort of unsatisfactory type job.
You should probably be citing who said that, just so it doesn't come across as our official line.
Well, it was my words, I take it.
Yeah, but you said, I just read that, so who was telling you that?
I'll look it up later, shall we? We'll add it to our blog. Right. Okay, so this explains this abundance of these new type of books in our library. We've got here Screw Work, Break Free by John Williams, brand new 2018 book. And so in it he describes so succinctly, what does screw work really mean? Well, it's not about living an empty life of doing nothing, quite the opposite. It's saying screw it to the outdated ideas of work as something you drag yourself to every day just to earn a paycheck. That work is something empty, dry and lacking any fun. So screw it is saying no, we're not going to, you know, live according to those old ways of just working and getting a paycheck. It goes on to say, how to launch your own money-making idea in 30 days.
Hmm. So I say
they are
buying into, although they may be abandoning the old custom of working for a paycheck, they're still buying into the idea of working for money.
Yeah.
and perhaps the newer idea of money being the most important thing of all, even higher than possibly than job satisfaction. Yeah. But anyway.
The next Elon Musk, etc.
I'm going to point out that actually gig economy is not necessarily such a recent thing as you think, because it goes back to ancient times, and I found this wonderful book. Do you know about the Uppity Women books?
No.
So Vicki Leon is an American who's written a series of books about women of the past, and it's called Uppity Women. And I think she might have had a website also or a blog that was about uppity women. Anyway, so she's written this great book, Orgy Planner Wanted, Odd Jobs and Curious Careers in the Ancient World. So first of all, I'd just like to put forth this one. There's one of these jobs. So we're talking ancient Rome, most of these, ancient Greece and ancient Rome. So this one is the job of job category of library.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're not going, oh, you are going.
Are you?
Go ahead.
Is this a new version of what we do?
Well, not new, because we're talking
old version.
Rome, so yeah, older version. So these were educated men, usually Greeks, because Rome at this point had conquered Greece, and so they had this surplus of educated Greeks who were no longer the ruling class because they'd been conquered by Rome, and they were available to serve as private secretaries, editors, copyists, also repairing scrolls, shout out to you, Preservation Unit, Auckland Libraries, and librarians. So library, that's probably the first use of that term that we now are so proud of.
So
proud
spelling
by.
Is the same? You're
well,
pronouncing
it
slightly different.
It has two I's at the end because,
oh, okay.
because it's Latin. But yeah, library is definitely the root. We've got that. And then another one I really loved was the nomenclator. Like, I think this is going to become, this could be revived. So the nomenclator, you know how I taught you Libro Cubicularis? It's just, do you remember what Libro Cubicularis was?
No.
1 week ago, 2 weeks ago. So that's somebody reading
something
in bed.
About a book.
It was
oh,
about reading
right.
in bed, the Libro Cubicularis. So this one, the nomenclator, is another one that I think is going to really catch on. So in ancient Rome, they did not have smartphones you could carry around and check your contacts. And so people who had creaky memories, rich people and powerful people, politicians, needed someone to, they needed actually to use a person since they didn't have a smartphone in their hand. So they had personal assistants that were called nomenclators who were selected for having amazing abilities to call up a name and a face, amazing memories, the best memories. And they would follow them around and whisper into their ear whenever they needed a prompt as to whom they were speaking.
Oh.
So I thought it was really great. And then the last one I really loved was the soul conductor. So this is like an early version of Ghostbusters. I'm just going to put, I'm not going to describe it. This isn't one about being a Ghostbuster. I think that's good enough. But I liked the name. I'm going to put this out there. The Psychopompus. That was the Latin term.
For Ghostbuster.
Psycho meaning soul. Yeah, for the Ghostbuster of the time.
Well, actually, that profession of, what did you call it again?
I called it psychopompous.
No, the one before.
Library. Nomenclator. Nomenclator.
That's not so, and perhaps it's been revived. Because do you remember the movie The Devil Wears Prada?
Don't remember the movie.
No, it's
did
book.
It have that? Did it have Chris Noth in it? No, who did it have?
Well, anyway.
Oh, I'm getting it mixed up with.
There's the scene
in
where
New York.
Emily Blunt's character, or was it Anne Hathaway? I can't remember. She whispers into Meryl Streep's ear the name and a brief bio of the people who are approaching them at these fashion events. So it's the same. Same role,
yeah.
isn't it?
I think we need a nomenclator because we can never remember the names of actors in movies. And The Devil Wears Prada, we should put a shout out to the name of the woman who wrote it, the book, not the movie. And it was Lauren, what's her name? Lauren starts with a W?
That's your area.
Lauren, I'm going to think Weisberger.
I just remembered the scene. You remember the names, yeah, I remember yeah. the images.
A genre-making book, anyway. It was in its time, it represented an entire genre, didn't it, of the shopping, of the books that named shopping goals. I think it was one of those representative books of its time in which a clear way to the heart of the reader was to slip into the text of the book shopping goals they would recognize.
Oh, okay. Missed that
Manolo Blahnik, their Prada.
Anyway, I want to go back to work. I found this really cool children's book in the library, and I think it sums up what we're talking about today. It's called Would You Believe? It's a Would You Believe book, sorry. It's called Bed Testers Get Paid to Sleep. But it's got a very cool intro. Let me get to the page. Where is the page? That is helping our children sort of understand work while preparing them for the work life ahead of them, you know. Work is as old as human life itself. Without it, the world's first people could not have lived. To eat, they had to hunt and gather seeds, fruits, and roots. Compared to factory or job, office jobs, this sounds easy. The hunter-gatherers labored for less than half of today's 9-to-5 routine. So work soon changed into something men and women did for a master exchange of land, which is you've been telling us about in the Victorian times. By the time these two 19th century fisher folk had paid jobs in boats and markets, work meant pretty much what it means today. So why should work interest you? Because you'll have to do it for 40 years. Poor children reading this.
Only 40. People are living longer. Try 70.
But I can see that we've run out of time for me to read their answer to the question, what is work? So,
but
we'll
you could give
that.
Us an example of one of the bed tester. One of the examples of the odd job.
Oh, yeah. Well, it then goes on to give a bit of history about work. The unemployment and depression, women's work, home or career, why not both?
I wanted to hear about the bed testers get paid to sleep. I wanted to hear.
Actually, we're doing.
Well, all right, let's not use that book for our examples of amazing jobs, because I have another book for you, which I can pass on to you. We can, since we didn't have some examples from bed testers, which is Careers for Introverts, which is I gave you yesterday. There it is, Careers for Introverts.
Okay.
So this is for you because you are such an introvert. I believe it's called, if I get it correctly, it's called Careers for Introverts and Other Solitary Types.
Okay, I see. So I'm going to find my
librarian. No, actually, funny enough, I don't think librarian's in it. Have a better look.
There's a potter. I could be a potter.
A potter? Is that
very artsy. Commercial artist.
Forest ranger was one of my favorite jobs.
That's close.
Archivist. Some similar to librarian. Yeah. You are kind of behind the scenes.
Computing professional or a forester.
I said that one. Yeah, forest ranger.
I was looking at the book. Okay, or jobs in the National Park Service. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and Postman is another job career for an introvert. So these are two books we found in the library. So one was Careers for Introverts, which is the one I've handed over
to Louisa,
because she's such an introvert. And I've handed over to myself Careers for Perfectionists, which is what I am. Although
not
I'm not
extrovert.
Actually sure.
What happened to the extrovert?
Well, it's been checked out by an extrovert who's in the library. So we just looked at what was on the shelf. So anyway, no perfectionist came across this book except me. But actually, I'm not so sure that I do fit into the perfectionist category because I'm very upset at seeing it described. So they've given some adjectives adjectives I might call them insults. Nitpicker or critical fusspot, according to them, is other ways of describing perfectionists, which I don't see myself as either of those types. But anyway,
what's the job it recommends for you?
It says, perfectionists are excellent fact finders. So that's where I think the librarianship comes in.
Okay, yeah, you've
some
already called me up on that.
Their talents to sifting through an incredible amount of information in order to locate a specific bit of knowledge. And who would make a better efficiency expert? So everyone listen to this line, please. Who would make a better efficiency expert than a true perfectionist? Well, I've got a lot of doubts about that one because in my experience, everyone is a perfectionist. Drags jobs out to the absolute max because they're so busy being a perfectionist and revising.
Yes, apparently that's the reason why people are procrastinators. We're perfectionists.
Right.
So, I've got another one. I've got another list, sorry. It's from the Bustle website.
Great website, yeah.
And it's jobs famous writers had before they became best-selling authors. So, Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird. She was a reservations flight attendant before being an author. And I like this. She eventually quit because her friends helped to support her financially so she could write.
Yeah, it's a time-honored tradition. They did that with Ezra Pound. Ernest Hemingway organized that for a fund for Ezra Pound to be able to write his poetry.
Wow,
With a rich American woman who had a temple in her garden, and Ezra was supposed to be able to sit in the garden and write his poetry. Mm-hmm. T.S. Eliot's, so Bloomsbury, Virginia Woolf and co. Put together a fund to get T.S. Eliot out of the insurance business. Was that where he was working? So he could write his books.
Well, this Margaret Atwood, she actually worked in a coffee shop, which I think is quite, common these days, I guess. But she...
Hospitality.
So she had to deal with a difficult cash register. A rude and ex-boyfriend would come by just to stare at her and barely tip, and fellow employees who were definitely not friendship material. It doesn't sound pleasant.
Yeah, so I'm quite surprised. I love this one. It's great. It gives me an opportunity to put out a shout-out for one of my favorite books. I think this is one of the books I read through the fastest. I remember staying up all night reading it. I just loved it, which was Patti Smith's memoir of her time in her early times in New York with Robert Mapplethorpe, which is called Just Kids. And speaking of difficult cash registers and rude ex-boyfriends, so Patti did not have a rude ex-boyfriend. She had Robert Mapplethorpe dropping in when she was working at, now I think it's the Strand bookstore, this part that I remember. I know she also worked at Scribner's bookstore. She worked at a number of bookstores. At Scribner's, I know she was fired for not charging tax. A Chinese customer came in and was buying a very expensive Buddha and she didn't charge him tax on it. She got fired. It had been the longest job she'd ever held. But I think it was at the Strand where she describes that she and Robert either dipped into the cash for just to help themselves out or to possibly, I think maybe they sold in quote marks, friends' books and didn't actually ring them up on the cash register. It was a little bit of a laxness going on there with the,
you'll have
the
to look that
drive to make money above all. Patty was already in on that.
these are serious accusations going on here, Karen. You better look that one up. Anyway, I've got a local author to add to the mix. I'm reading Red Herring by Jonathan Cullinane, who was a filmmaker but then became a postal worker while writing his first novel.
Speaking of what jobs people had before they became writers.
That's right. Yeah, I'm throwing a local author into that mix.
The postie. The mailman was a job for an introvert. It was in our book, Jobs for Introverts.
I think he's just a postal worker to help get the book written, maybe. So some of our listeners may have attended Jonathan's author talk at the Grayland Library when the book was first came out. It's a very cool local book. I'm really enjoying reading it. It's historical, crime, action story, set amongst the events surrounding the 1951 Auckland waterfront and wharfie strike events.
Speaking of the labor movement.
Yes, yeah. So
excuse me, just putting it out there in the theater of the mind, I had a fist when I said speaking
she
of the
did.
Labor movement, I had my fist in the air. Lisa saw that you
She's not, wearing a red cap today, she just had her fist up. But some of the characters are real, some are fictional, like the main character, private investigator Johnny Malloy. So I'm enjoying it. What I'm really enjoying is reading a story set in my own city. It's just like...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For example, how unique is this to read a car chase scene and you're able to follow the route, okay? So they go, they leave the Grayland Returned Services Club, isn't it?
Yeah.
They go up Richmond Road into Chamberlain Street and turn left into Rose Street. And
Rose Road,
yeah. And then they end up at a dead end, which I couldn't picture in my mind.
They would have turned the other way into Rose Road. I know exactly, as I walked that route to the library, they would have turned the other way into Rose Road and ended up where it dead ends above Grayland Park, home of the Richmond Rovers rugby team.
And their car slams into a fence and they run away. They get away, make a getaway. Yeah. So the chapters are very short. So I guess this is Jonathan's film background coming out, because it felt like I was in scenes in a movie, you know. So if you can get a hold of a copy of this book to read on Neighbour Day, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, the Grayland Library, I believe he presented, didn't he do an author talk on this book at the Grayland Library?
Yeah.
The reason I know that is because I was at the Grayland Library just before World Book Night, and I photographed Jonathan Cullinane's book, which they had recently presented. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't getting the wrong book, but I remember because it had a bright red cover.
Here it is here.
We posed it in their library with a moor pork. With it, a little stuffed moor pork, not a real moor pork. I'd like to think the Grayland Library, with that beautiful old building, it could have just the space for a moor pork in the belfry, but this was a stuffed moor pork from Storytime. And we put it up for World Book Night, recommending it as a nighttime read. Possibly not if you're easily scared. But that's good. So that's taken us through the wharfie period, the other, more updated since the factory struggles of Charles Dickens or the 8-hour workday. And I've got one more to put out there, because this was speaking of more contemporary labor struggles. I think I'm confident in saying that an equivalent of the struggle for the 8-hour working day in our times is the struggle for the minimum wage, for the living wage, for a decent minimum wage. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm.
This is nodding sagely. And I read an absolutely fantastic book that I want to recommend, this writer and the book, to everyone. So she's Barbara Ehrenreich. She's an American writer, journalist, and she went undercover. She wrote a book. She writes about social issues. She wrote a book called Nickel and Dimed on Getting By in America. And basically, she goes around America for a year taking on minimum wage jobs and seeing how can you get along. And she discovers that, no, you have to sleep in your car and you have to do this and you have to do that. And it's very demeaning. And I think the worst scene of all is the one where she's at Walmart with a bunch of other women taking care of children and leading complicated lives. And they've got the uppity young male supervisor coming along and tell them that they're not allowed to speak while folding the clothes.
Oh.
So, yeah, the struggle never ends. And
what year was that?
can't tell you because it's 29 minutes. And we're
it was after
you
the welfare
can't
reform.
Do that
act.
To me.
It was after
the okay, and I'll tell you. It was after the welfare reform act was at the end of the 90s.
Aww.
I don't know exactly what year it was, but anyway, that was our show for today. And thanks for listening. And keep up la lucha. And enjoy your Labor Day holiday.
Yes, right? Enjoy.
Kakiteano. This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz
and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m.
on 104.6 FM
or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond. Every day.